So, good evening, everyone. Tonight is our fourth and last installment in our series on the Dharma of Poetry, which means the Dharma to be found in poetry that is not necessarily by Buddhist poets or with any explicit Dharma content. But as we're finding, much poetry is pretty rich in Dharma. So we've talked about different ways that the practice of Zen or meditation and the practice of poetry are similar and complementary. The way that both play in the fields of paradox and uncertainty. The way they tap deep sources in our mind, beneath and beyond our conventional rational ways of thinking. And the way that they surprise us with what we did not know what we knew. Also in the way that they turn and open and transform us. The way they jostle us out of our habitual ruts. Like the self that only exists and is enlivened in relationship with other existences, like our existence, which only exists in the matrix of other existences, a poem only comes alive in the space between the poet, the poem, and the reader, right? Or listener. As our verse that we chant during a formal Zen meal says, or calls this, the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And I think we enter into that emptiness in taking in poetry. Giver, receiver, and gift. And then when it's a poem that's been translated from another language, then there's the poet, the poem, the reader, and the translator too. And so tonight, I want to talk about poetry as translation. Notice I'm not saying the translation of poetry, which is included, but poetry as translation. So I'm going to start with a poem. And for those of you who would like to read along as I read it, I'll pass it out. By a Polish poet, a 20th century Polish poet, whose name I will venture to pronounce as Zbigniew Herbert. Anybody want to correct me? Feel free. Waiting for everybody to get their copy. The title is I Would Like to Describe. I would like to describe the simplest emotion, joy or sadness, but not as others do, reaching for shafts of rain or sun. I would like to describe a light which is being born in me, but I know it does not resemble any star, for it is not so bright, not so pure, and is uncertain. I would like to describe courage without dragging behind me a dusty lion, and also anxiety without shaking a glass full of water. To put it another way, I would give all metaphors in return for one word drawn out of my breast like a rib, for one word contained within the boundaries of my skin. But apparently this is not possible. And just to say, I love. I run around like mad, picking up handfuls of birds. And my tenderness, which after all is not made of water, asks the water for a face. And anger, different from fire, borrows from it a loquacious tongue. So is blurred in me what white-haired gentleman separated once and for all and said, this is the subject and this is the object. We fall asleep with one hand under our head and with the other in a mound of planets. Our feet abandon us and taste the earth with their tiny roots, which next morning we tear out painfully. So he's describing the impossibility of capturing even the simplest emotion in words. Right? He's describing how we use metaphor, which both is and is not like what we're trying to describe. How, as humans who have invented language, we reach into the earth and into the heavens again and again in our attempts to express ourselves. So words themselves are translations, aren't they, of the thing itself. The object, the feeling, the thought. Snowflakes falling outside, each with its own weight, shape, and movement. The sadness of not being able to share the snowfall with someone you love who's far away. How to give that words. In Zen, words are called a finger pointing at the moon. I think many of you have heard that expression. The moon is the clear light of awakening, and we're asked not to mistake the finger for the experience itself. And yet the Zen literature is full of poetry pointing that finger towards the moon, right? Using images both lofty and lowly to depict the experience of being awake to this moment, this snowfall, this child laughing, this frog jumping into the pond. Ralph Waldo Emerson, in a wonderful passage, called words fossil poetry. I'm going to read you that passage. Though the origin of most of our words is forgotten, each word was at first a stroke of genius and obtained currency because, for the moment, it symbolized the world to the first speaker and to the hearer. The etymologist finds the deadest word to have once been a brilliant picture. Language is fossil poetry. As the limestone of the continent consists of infinite masses of shells of animalcules, so language is made up of images or tropes, which now, in their secondary use, have long ceased to remind us of their poetic origin. That fossil life within the word is much more evident in Chinese and Japanese than in English, because in those languages we see the image and the metaphor sprinkled throughout the characters themselves. We see earth, water, fire, air, clouds, rain and wind, mountains and rivers, trees and grasses, right there in the visuals of the characters. We see eyes and ears and mouths. Each of these originally pictographs became the building blocks of Chinese characters, and the basic elements are called radicals, and they're used in myriad combinations as ideographs to represent abstract concepts, feelings, objects, And as we see these representations, as we read, we intuit a kind of constructed nature of perception and thought and language. Just because we see those constructions. The earliest forms of these characters date back to about 1200 BC. And they were first inscribed on bones and turtle shells, which, because they were used in divination ceremonies, they were called oracle bones. So I'm going to show you some examples. Unfortunately, I don't have any. It's really fun to look at the progression from the earliest oracle bone representations and how they changed through the centuries to the present day. And I don't have any, you know, really. If you go online, you can find some. But what I have here is the Japanese word for word, kotoba. This part's koto, and this part's ba. These are actually two separate characters. And this is the character, this part is the character for speech. So this is a mouth, and then these are the kind of sound waves. I mean, they wouldn't have known about sound waves then, but somehow that's how they represented the sound coming out of the mouth. And then this part is leaf. So words are leaves of sound or leaves of speech, which I just love. And this ba, the character for some of you, sorry, I'm not showing this very well. This part of it is tree, this bottom part. This part up here is grass. And this part in the middle is world. And I'm not sure. I have to do a little bit more research to see if there's an explanation for why world is in there. You can understand the tree and the grass. But anyway, that becomes leaf. So leaves of speech is words, language, kotoba. And then, poem. Poem, this is a little bit more cursive in style, you can see, but this is the same part. Speech, right? Or words. Or, yeah, speech. Because originally poetry would have been oral, of course. So speech. And this part is the character for temple. And temple consists of a hand. This lower part is a hand, like sort of a hand that's kind of grasping like this. And then this part is a seedling coming out of the earth. Here's the earth, and then here's the stem and the little, you know, leaflets. So what's that got to do with temple? Well, it's an offering. This is very, very old, right? Offering to on an altar of to fertility offer. So it's we put flowers on the altar. People have been putting flowers on altars for a very, very long time, and probably candles and water and yeah. So a hand making an offering on an altar becomes temple, and words offered at that time, make a poem, right? Would have been a poem. So right there you see a kind of visual construct of what a poem is. I remember when after I'd been studying Japanese for some years, and I had got to the point where I could read fiction mostly on the train without having a dictionary there all the time, and it was really a wonderful feeling, and I realized that I was that there's a way that reading felt different. Anybody who here who, you know, reads Chinese is, or Japanese, yeah, it feels different, doesn't it? Sort of, yeah. In the year 907, a Japanese poet named Kino Tsurayuki wrote an introduction to a great anthology of poetry called the Kokinshu. And his opening lines were, "The poetry of Japan has its roots in the human heart and flourishes in the countless leaves of words." So that was, I was going to read you that quote to go with the with Kotoba, "The countless leaves of words." So fossil poetry in English is less visible, though maybe more so in nouns, particularly those that name living things, like tiger swallowtail, which is not a tiger or a swallow, but a
butterfly.
And lady slipper, which is a, it's a little wild orchid, or killdeer, which is a, yeah, it's a shorebird, and killdeer doesn't mean that it's named after killing deer. It's what someone decided the call sounded like. Killdeer, killdeer. Yeah. So we do have fossil poetry in our language as well. Maybe we're losing it. I read recently that in 2007, the Oxford Junior Dictionary, so this is aimed at school children, eliminated the following words: adder, ash, beech, bluebell, buttercup, catkin, cowslip, cygnet, cygnet as in a baby swan, dandelion, fern. Fern? Dandelion, heather, heron, ivy, kingfisher, lark, mistletoe, nectar, newt, otter, pasture, and willow dropped from the dictionary, and added were attachment, block graph, blog, broadband, bullet point, celebrity, chat room, committee, cut and paste, MP3 player, and voicemail. I rest my case. So the first set of words are much more clearly metaphors, but so are the others. One thing being described in terms of another. But we're usually quite unaware of the degree to which our language is saturated with metaphor. Consider the use of, and this is from a book called Metaphors We Live by Lakoff. Oh, I didn't bring it with me. It's not a new book, but it's kind of a classic. So consider, for example, the use of war metaphors in discussing argument or differing points of view. He shot down each point I made. You can never win an argument with him. You need to defend that statement. Can you imagine a linguistic culture in which expressing differences in perspective was not done with the language of attack? That would be different. Another common and completely taken for granted metaphor is time as money. You know, we speak of wasting time, investing, spending, and sparing time. Even special words like up and down, near and far, spatial words, are used metaphorically all the time without even thinking about it. There's much more. It's the book is very rich in examples. We could argue that virtually all of our human communication involves translation of experience into words, into meaning. Right? Into meaning which may or may not be shared, even by those who speak the same language. How many times in an exchange with a friend or a partner have you said or heard, "but you said," or "but that's not what I meant," right? Using words that we think are perfectly clear, but the person doesn't receive them in the way that we expect them to. So even within one language group, there are many cultural factors that determine and color the meanings of our words. The eminent translator Elliot Weinberger has commented, "Every reading of every poem, regardless of the language, is an act of translation. Translation into the reader's intellectual and emotional life." So no wonder translation from one language into another is fraught with peril, especially with poetry, as opposed to, say, an instruction manual for a camera. Robert Frost, the poet, American poet Robert Frost, once quipped, "Poetry is what's lost in translation." True sometimes. And the Italian saying, traduttore traditore, which means translator traitor, expresses an understandable uneasiness, a sort of defensiveness about giving one's linguistic and cultural heritage and treasures into the hands of someone from a different language and culture. And yet, without translation, how would any exchange, whether of information, goods, or poetry, take place? How would cross-pollinization between cultures ever occur? Which it has since the beginning of human culture. The 20th century Mexican poet Octavio Paz counters what Frost and the Italian saying maintain. And he says this. He's saying that poetry is what gets transformed in translation. He says, "After all, poetry is not merely the text. The text produces the poem, a set of sensations and meanings, with different means, but playing a similar role, you can produce similar results. I say similar, but not identical. Translation is an art of analogy, the art of finding correspondences, an art of shadows and echoes, of producing with a different text a poem similar to the original." I've sort of collected these quotes about translation because I really enjoy translation. It's kind of an exhilarating mental yoga. So here's another one I like. This is the Canadian poet and novelist Anne Michaels. She says, "Translation is a kind of transubstantiation. One poem becomes another. You can choose your philosophy of translation just as you choose the philosophy you live by. The free adaptation that sacrifices detail to meaning, or the strict crib that sacrifices meaning to exactitude. The poet moves from life to language. The translator moves from language to life, or maybe and then back to language, but a different language." And then she says, "Both, like the immigrant, try to identify the invisible, what's between the lines." Oh, no, that's... Oh, I have "what's between the lives." Is that a typo? Did she say "what's between the lines" or "between the lives"? Yeah, it's between the lives, but it's a good play on between the lines. Yeah, like the immigrant, the poet... The translator, like the immigrant, tries to identify the invisible, what's between the lives, between the lines, the mysterious implications. I didn't even catch that when I... So transubstantiation. It felt something like that when I was translating Japanese haiku, because, you know, Japanese being a very different, completely different language from English, felt like a kind of metamorphosis, like the original poem had to deconstitute, kind of in the, like my brain was a kind of chrysalis, and this metamorphosis would happen, and then it would reconstitute and be born as a poem in English. The analogy doesn't quite hold, because of course in metamorphosis the caterpillar goes in and the butterfly comes out, whereas in poetry you want something that's equally beautiful, or has, and yet not the same, not identical. When we look at more than one translation of the same poem, it helps us to see the multiplicity of meanings and aspects that emerge from this interaction of poet, poem, and reader and translator. And in a few moments I'm going to give you two different versions of the same poem to look at. I hope that this exploration of the Dharma of poetry over the last few weeks has opened up some possibilities for you to find Dharma pearls in poetry, and to get a feeling for this emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. And that you can take that forward not only in poetry that you might read and enjoy and appreciate, but also in the Zen texts that we read and chant here. To read these Dharma texts in the way that you would read poetry, as translation and as this kind of creative interaction with the words and between the lines, between the lives. So I'm going to close my part of this evening with a quote that I was going to read you a couple weeks ago, except that I forgot the book. And this is called The Life of Poetry by 20th century American poet Muriel Rukeyser. This is from the opening of her book. She says, In time of crisis, we summon up our strength. And she wrote this immediately following, right after the end of World War II. In time of crisis, we summon our strength. Then, if we are lucky, we are able to call every resource, every forgotten image that can leap to our quickening, every memory that can make us know our power. And this luck is more than it seems to be. It depends on the long preparation of the self to be used. In time of the crises of the spirit, we are aware of all our need for each other and our need for ourselves. We call up with all the strength of summoning we have our fullness. And then we turn, for it is the turning, for it is a turning that we have prepared, and act. The time of the turning may be very long. It may hardly exist. And then she goes on to tell the incident of traveling in an overloaded boat of refugees leaving Europe, which I talked about a few weeks ago. So she's talking about our need for poetry in times of crisis, and I believe we are in a time of crisis now in our world, and that we do need to tap the deep sources of our courage and our interconnectedness to be able to respond to the the world around us. And that both poetry and Zen are two of my most treasured deep resources for doing that. There are others. There are quite a few others. I thought my wish in bringing this poetry to the Zendo was to share that treasured deep resource with you, and to encourage you to tap it, or those others that are that give you courage in your daily lives, yeah, in this world. So I think I'll stop there.